Leslie, why aren't you up there?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to, at this time, call a meeting of House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it's about 1:38 on Thursday, April 20th. Present today, Representative Ortiz is excused. Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Seaton, myself, Representative Tilton, Representative Green, Gren, Representative Guttenberg, and Representative Thompson and Co-Chair Foster are excused. So before we start, I want to remind everybody about their cell phones. And at this meeting, we will be having the introductory hearings on HB 74, which is the driver's license and ID cards and the Real ID Act bill from the governor. Committee will be getting an introduction of the bill and will be taking invited testimony. Is there any business to come before the committee before we start? Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, while we have this discussion, I know there's been an issue with the multi-state group that we went and how protected our information is with them. That can be addressed as well. So, because this, again, we're talking about doing the same type of activity, giving Alaskans information out and whether or not it's going to be protected.
And we will have a presentation by the commissioner and commissioner's representative, and I think that'll be a great question for them. Anything else?
Just brief.
And by the way, public testimony will be next Tuesday, just so everybody, let me get the time for everybody, in case anybody listening, will be Tuesday, April 25th from 4:30 to 7 p.m., and that testimony will be limited to 2 minutes. Today we are getting the introduction of the bill and invited testimony from different groups, getting those, and then we'll go to individual call-in testimonies from the LIOs on Tuesday. So, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in case legislators and staff don't get enough of their Real ID fill this day, NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures, is holding a webinar that's tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock to discuss the Real ID Act. Just some of the controversial issues that keep coming up. There's going to be a speaker who's from the Coordination Office of Policy in the Department of Homeland Security, as well as other staff available for questions. So that's a webinar tomorrow, and we'll make sure staff gets copies of the invitation so that they can register. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anything further? Seeing none, let's go to the introduction of the bill, and I believe we have the Commissioner of Administration online. Mr. Fisher, would you introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and start your introduction, and we'll have Deputy Commissioner come to the table. So if there's if you're going to be running through the PowerPoint, she'll be running it for you. So
Thank you, Representative Seaton. I appreciate the opportunity to come and present to you. I'm sorry that I can't be there in person. We have ARM board meetings these next few days in Anchorage, and that's taking me out of town. But as you noted, Deputy Commissioner Leslie Rydell is at the table with you. Seated with me in the room is Marla Thompson, who's the director of the DMV. And I understand that also on the phone we have Mike Stanker from the Department of Law if there's legal questions. We also have Brian Duffy, I believe, from the DMVA, as they're impacted by this, as well as Captain Lauder from the Department of Public Safety that has an interest in some of the aspects of this legislation. I know that it's hard sometimes to manage the back and forth when the presenter is on the phone, and so I will pause for a moment periodically, and hopefully if there's questions, we can manage that, and you can alert me when you have questions. At this stage, if there aren't questions, I'll move to slide two. And just to provide a little bit of a background, the Federal Real ID Act covers all 50 states, and it establishes minimum requirements for identification to be used for that ID to be valid in federal facilities. And I think that's an important point to keep in mind. I think that sometimes there's an argument that the federal government should not require states to dictate to states how they might produce identification. I think that's a valid concern. I think the federal government would argue that they're not mandating that states do anything. They're just setting a standard if individuals want to use state identification in federal facilities. I'll talk a little bit more about exactly how it works, but the process mandated by RealID, in essence, requires us to do two things. First of all, it requires us to take a photo at the beginning of the process and to use that photo to compare against the individual that is receiving a license at the end of the process to ensure there has not been any fraud between the person presenting the documents for validation and the person that is actually photographed and receives the license or identification. It then also requires that we validate the primary documents that are used in establishing eligibility for a license. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in more detail. There are 26 states today that offer RealID compliant cards. There are 20 more states, including Alaska, that have extensions. And so while we do not offer a RealID card today, we are not out of compliance, and so Alaska residents have not been impacted by the RealID Act, although I'll talk a little bit about how that might change. There are currently four states that are non-compliant, and that means these are states that do not have a RealID card and have not received a waiver, and you can see that they're Minnesota, Missouri, Maine, and Montana. Washington recently both received a waiver from the Department of Homeland Security, and they also have the RealID version of a Compliance Act similar to what we're discussing today has passed both houses of the Washington legislature. I don't believe it's been signed into law yet, however. If there aren't questions, I'll move to slide three.
Let me ask around, are there questions? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So what is the difference between, I mean, when you're talking about a compliant card, you're talking about the passport card or something with a chip or, I mean, you have down here farther down with non-compliant, but Minnesota has an enhanced IDs with a chip cards. Could you explain that?
So I will, and then we'll go into much more detail through the presentation, but essentially, there are certain requirements to have a RealID compliant card. There also, as I understand it, I'm not expert on these enhanced ID with chips, but as I understand it, those also satisfy the federal requirement as a card that will be acceptable. We don't have either, and so if without a change in the law, our residents would be required to have an alternative form of identification, so a passport or some other version. And we've got a list that if you want to go into that. Is that?
If you're going to go into it in more detail later, that's fine.
Yeah, and would you hold on for a minute? We've got a vacuum cleaner outside the window here. A big one. thank you. So Representative Guttenberg said he would wait for a further explanation during the
if there's more detailed comment.
So we're going to go to Representative Wilson and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the non-compliant states, you have Missouri and Maine. So what issues have arisen with Missouri and Maine? There, it doesn't look like there's anything in their legislature, and I'm assuming they have to use passports instead of their driver's license. Is that true?
I'm going to say it's partially true at this stage, and so today, and this gets to the question of what are the consequences of not passing this legislation. And as it's being enforced today, those consequences may vary. And so, for example, an individual with a non-compliant license in one of those four states, if they try to get on a base, they will be forced, either they'll be turned away or they'll be have limited access where they have to be actually accompanied by an official from the base to make their to do their business, and that has is somewhat cumbersome, and it limits the amount of time and what they can do on the base. But so far, today, to travel and to pass TSA, there are actually alternatives. And so if you show up today without a license, you can verify yourself in other ways, or you can offer an alternative form of identification, or you can be subject to enhanced search and still get through through the security process. We're being told, and we have asked this question numerous times in numerous ways, we're being assured that after January, a individual that attempts to travel without a real ID or an alternative form of identification will be turned away. In other words, there will not be the options that are available today, for example, to subject yourself to an enhanced search and be able to pass through TSA. And so these states, Maine and Montana, for example, they either present an alternative form of identification, or they might have the option, they would have the option to be able to subject themselves to an enhanced search, for example. In the future, that option will be taken away, and they will be limited to presenting an alternative form of identification.
Follow-up,
Representative Wilson.
So I know Missouri has some pretty big bases, federal bases in Missouri, and their population's a lot more. I guess I just find it interesting that we haven't heard a lot of complaints on why either one, Missouri or Maine, have decided that what they're doing is not a good idea. So if you have any information on issues that maybe we just haven't read about, but Missouri's pretty close to as far as having bases, federal buildings and things like that, but a much larger population, it just seems like we would hear a lot of negatives if this was really something we needed to do right now. Thank you.
I have a handful of examples that have been shared with me, but I wonder if Brian Duffy is on the line. I don't know whether you're in a position to talk specifically about what may be happening at Missouri bases and can address that question perhaps more comprehensively.
I don't think he's on the line, is he?
Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Coachman, this is Brian Duffy from the DMBA.
Oh, great. Go ahead with if you heard the question.
Through the chair, to the representative's question, so Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri is an example, a federal installation that is out there now. And while I don't have the stats, really relate them with respect to drug-based armadillo Richardson, which, again, is before I retired from active duty. I served as the commander of the installation up here from 2012 to 14. So in speaking with officials of Jaybird, there's an estimate of 14,000 local service providers and contractors that will be affected and required to have alternative forms of identification or be otherwise unable to access the installation. And noting the point about escort, it would be certainly highly unreasonable to assume the installation would provide escort for all these visitors. And for those that participated in the Joint Armed Services Committee hearing, you heard Lieutenant General Wolzbach, the commander of Alaska Command and 11th Air Force, make the same pitch. Mr. Co-Chair, I've also received information from Fort Wainwright, who provide estimates of about 5,000 a month, and Eielson Air Force Base provide estimates of 2,600 per month.
I think the question was, have there been problems in Missouri?
On their base.
On their bases in Missouri, have you heard of any problems there?
I have not been tracking specific problems, Mr. Co-Chair, of bases in Missouri.
Okay, thank you.
And they're non-compliant, so that kind of makes you wonder.
But I guess, Leslie, if you would like to, we can give, it's just one example, but we do have an example of an individual that in Washington, and Washington was not compliant until a couple of weeks ago that was subject to these same rules. In other words, they had very limited access. And Leslie, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
No, that's okay. We just wanted to know about Missouri. So, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Representative Guerra. A question on your statement on Washington. When Real ID was passed, I had privacy concerns, and we passed legislation to implement our privacy concerns, but now we are where we are. You just mentioned that Washington got an extension by passing a statute. Does their extension last any longer than our extension, which I understand expires in January? Am I right about any of that? How long does Washington's extension extend to?
So the way our extension works is right now it expires on June 6th. And so starting on June 7th, Real ID compliant identification, either a license or whatever, would be required under normal circumstances. We have been assured, however, that if this legislation passes, we will receive another extension that will give us a window of opportunity in which we can become compliant. The Department of Homeland Security understands that it's going to take a period of implementation. So for Alaskans, if this passes, we will receive another waiver and we'll have a window of opportunity to complete the work. I will also say, however, that we have been in conversation with the Department of Homeland Security and have been assured that if this legislation doesn't pass, we will not receive another waiver. And we even made the argument that, and I don't know whether this is an anathema with this group, but we said if the session is still ongoing in June and this bill is still pending, can we get a waiver even through the end of session? And we were informed that we could not. And so I think it's the impact will be present if this doesn't pass before June 6th, we will be in a mode where we are non-compliant like other states. I've got to confess, I don't know how long the Washington State waiver lasts. It just got pulled up. So their waiver also lasts through June 6th. But I'm sure they have also received assurances that assuming their bill is signed into law, that they will receive another waiver that will extend it and give them an opportunity to become compliant as well.
And was that Mr. Duffy or the commissioner that was responding?
I'm sorry, this is Commissioner Fisher. I'll do better to identify myself.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we have number of voices, so if you're responding to a question, please make sure to just state your name. You don't have to state anything other than that, but that would be helpful for the secretary here. So are there further questions? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just for you. I know that there's a list of testifiers that are online on behalf of the departments and the administration, and it might be helpful if we all got it so we knew who to direct the most appropriate questions to. I had a copy. I've lost it.
And we have staff that are okay. Going to...
Thank you.
Anything further? Go ahead, Commissioner.
Okay, this is Commissioner Fisher, and I'm moving to slide 3. This bill is required because current state law prohibits the Division of Motor Vehicles from spending state funds to comply with the Real ID Act. And so without a change in state law, we cannot proceed. I think most of the other things we've talked about on this page. And so if there aren't questions, I'll move to slide 4.
Questions? Representative Kawasaki has one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a letter that I don't have in front of me from somebody from the ACLU saying that you are in fact collecting information outside of the original scope of a typical driver's license. Is that correct?
No. I mean, let me tell you what we collect and I think the basis, and if there's more legal questions, the Department of Law can address them. So when a person, we are by statute allowed to collect their application and maintain their application, and we do that. We're also by statute allowed to maintain their and store their photos. As part of their applications, we maintain and keep whatever primary documents that they, a copy of whatever primary documents that they have given to us. And so whether it's a birth certificate or passport or some other primary document that, that might be shared. And so that is part of the application, and we maintain that, and we have the authority under our regulations to do that. And that also has a number of benefits. In other words, it allows us to reissue a license. If it's lost, it allows us to reissue a license upon expiration without demanding that people bring in their primary documents again. And so being able to store that information does provide a real benefit to our residents.
Thanks, and Representative Galison, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you saying when you say that you are able to collect and you take this data, are you and the state of Alaska has sole possession of this data? This data is not going to any other databases?
Through the chair, that's correct. We keep this data. We do not share this data. The only data that we share is... And we'll talk a little bit more about this, but as part of our issuance process, we confirm that a individual does not have a license in another state. And to do that, we share a minimal amount of private information that does include five digits of their Social Security number is, I think, the most sensitive part of that. We don't share their application. We do not share their photo. We do not share the primary document that they've given to us. All of that stays within the state of Alaska. We do not share that with anyone outside of Alaska.
Follow up,
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And Commissioner, was the five-digit Social Security number, was that what we've always done by way of driver's licenses? Or is that something new that the department has recently done?
That's a great question, through the chair. So that is something that we have started doing recently. There was a new system that was stood up, and it did require, as mandates, of five digits. Now, this is something that I think this process has highlighted for me personally, and that I appreciate the sensitivity. And so we are in discussions with the organization is called AMBA. It's an organization that is established by all of the DMVs in Alaska and Canada to facilitate this transfer of information. And Marla Thompson, who's with me, is assuming a role on their board, and we are going to see if we can't reduce the number of digits that are shared and try to minimize that. The only other thing I guess I would say is that for commercial driver's licenses, we did share the full Social Security number, and that is, if I'm understanding correctly, that's required by federal law.
And then one last. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the latitude. Was the five-digit Social Security number a requirement under the Real ID Act?
It was not. It's a system that has been put in place to try to simplify the process of comparing and ensuring that an individual does not inappropriately have multiple licenses from multiple jurisdictions. We've always done that. And I think it's important to recognize when we went to this new system, and Ms. Thompson will give me the number, but there were a few thousand individuals that actually did have multiple licenses that had fallen through our process. And so there is, I think, an important fraud detection component to this system that, does have a benefit, I think, for us.
I guess,
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, is it illegal to have more than one driver's license in different jurisdictions?
It is. It's a violation of our state law.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when you're talking about the new system, are you talking about when we did a contract with the organization in Indiana?
I'm referring to, it's sometimes referred to as state-to-state, and it's a new system that was set up and is managed and administered by AMVA, which is the American Association of Motor Vehicles something.
So follow-up. So was that in the legislation that Senator Michicki had? I think it was last year when we joined the multi-state. Is that where it came from?
I think you referred to ERIC, which was around information around ensuring that there was not fraud in voter registrations.
Yes.
So this is different. So it is true that under ERIC, we do share the same type of information. The state shares that already. That is not done by us, that's done by the Division of Elections, as I understand it. Nope, I'm being told.
It's both.
I guess both, we both share that data with ERIC, and then, but this is a separate system.
And so just with that system, Mr. Chairman, so is it the same five-digit Social Security, or are we giving all the information through this other system, through ERIC?
I'm sorry, Representative, could you repeat the question?
So are we just giving the five-digit Social Security number, or are we giving the entire Social Security number when we're talking about this other system about voter registration?
So ERIC is four digits of the Social Security number. It does have slightly different information, but in terms of the Social Security number, it's only four digits.
It might be only four digits, but I think that's still too many for many.
Thank you, and let's try. We've got a lot of slides, so let's try and hold questions to clarification questions until we get to the end. So go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you. This is Commissioner Fisher. So I'm on slide four now. And this bill, I guess it's important. We intentionally structured this bill to offer Alaskans a choice. And so if an individual does not want a real ID compliant license, they do not have to obtain one. But those of us who would like to have a real ID compliant license, this gives the DMV the ability to establish that license and to spend money to do that. It also allows us to extend the term of a license from 5 years to 8 years long. The bill also attempts to address some privacy concerns. It directs the DMV to destroy scanned documents once the minimal retention is met. It creates a limit of 9 years for photo storage for non-compliant driver's license and an ID. It prohibits the DMV from scanning, copying, or retaining any form documents for a non-compliant ID, and restricts data sharing with entities to the minimal amount necessary to be certified for a real ID. So it allows us to share Social Security and other information minimally required to comply with real ID, and allows us to continue to share data with ERIC for voter registration. It requires the DMV to work with other states to address the use of Social Security numbers, and this is what I referred to a moment ago, where we are going to try to reduce the number of digits that we share, and it prohibits the DMV from bulk sharing of photos, which we've never done, but this would prohibit us from doing that. I guess I should pause here, and I don't know if you would like to
to discuss this, but I believe that Captain Lauder is on the line from public safety, and I think that it is important to understand that public safety uses this material for a number of, I think, important and legitimate purposes, including missing persons, identifying individuals that might have died for whatever reason, as well as in their criminal investigative activity. And so I don't know if you'd like to pause, but I think that DPS does have a some concerns with the limitation of that is presented in this bill.
And without objections, we'll go ahead and go. And who was that with? Was that with the public safety?
This has been Commissioner Fisher testifying, but Captain Lauder from DPS is on the line. If you would like to speak with him,
While we're there on this slide, let's go. Mr. Loudon, are you there, Captain?
Chair, yes, sir. This is Captain Dan Loudon with the troopers.
Great. Would you like to address this issue of these elements on privacy concerns?
Well, we have some concerns about our ability to have access to the photos and the documents, and I believe that the department has sent a letter which outlines those. I don't want to repeat the thing in entirety, but we use these photographs and these documents for a myriad of tools to help people, to help us solve crimes. We use them for missing person flyers, for wanted persons flyers. We use them to help us identify deceased persons. Not everyone has their identification with them. We use them on the street when people don't have their identification. Having the photos available, we can call through to the dispatch center. They can pull up the photo. We get some information from the person that can be emailed or text to the officer on the street, to a cell phone or a in-car computer, and the photos there and can help identify them at that point. We use them for creating photo lineups, photo arrays. If we're trying to identify a suspect, we need to pick out other photographs that are similar to that wanted person. The Records and Identification Bureau is working quite frequently to reconcile records. There are times when people will acquire criminal histories using different names, and we need to try and merge those records. There are times when people have similar-looking names, and they are called upon to try and determine whether they are the same person or two different people, and which part of that criminal history or their driving record belongs with which person. There's a myriad of things we use these documents for, and interfering with that or restricting that, if I use those words, would also just impair our ability to conduct investigations, find missing people, and so forth.
Thank you. Are there questions, Representative Guerra?
Look, we don't want to create unnecessary costs for little reason, but if you have an interest in having this information before the Department of Motor Vehicles destroys it, could they just not transfer it to you if that's information that's important to you?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I'm not sure I understood the question. If they destroy it, we wouldn't have access to it.
Right, through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I understand your concern. Without any major additional cost before destroying it, could they transfer the information to you so you had it? for the law enforcement and public protection purposes. You mentioned it, and then they could afterwards destroy it so that you still had it, even though DMV didn't keep it.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, I think that would be one way to approach this.
And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Probably too quick for you to get an answer right now. I don't know. I suppose there would probably be some cost to that. I don't know. But if there wouldn't be any cost to that would seem to be the ideal situation if you were able to encrypt the information and protect it. But I'm just tossing that out there.
And thank you. And I guess the question is, if the bill does, as slide 4 says here, prevents them from scanning, copying, retaining any documents for noncompliance, if they can't scan them, they wouldn't be able to give them to another agency in the state. So that is something that we can talk about later, whether people just don't want the DMV to be the depository of this information and want Department of Public Safety to be the repository of information. But we have your letter, your two-page letter. It doesn't it raises issues, but it doesn't have a request for 20-year retention, 30-year retention, unlimited retention. So if there is a request for a certain provision to be changed, then maybe you can forward that to us if you're not prepared to talk about it right now.
Mr. Chair, we would probably like to have the information as long as we could that would be reasonable that it might be used. We've actually used this information in cold cases that are a number of years old, and so I will talk with the commissioner's office and so forth, and we'll forward some sort of a timeline for you.
Thank you. Is there further questions of public safety? Not seeing any. Thank you. Commissioner, you want to take over again?
Right. So this is Commissioner Sheldon Fisher. By the way, I certainly appreciate the reference to perhaps the DMV is not the best repository, and we don't really feel like we've got a stake in that, but I did want to share that the data is encrypted in our databases today, so if there's any question about that. As you can see here, this also prohibits the state or municipalities from requiring that people have a Real ID compliant license. It also imposes an additional fee of $20 that will cover the cost of issuing these licenses. And so, in addition to offering Alaskans the choice, those who choose Real ID compliant licenses will pay an additional fee to cover the cost. It also allows the DMV to offer licenses to non-U.S. citizens for up to 8 years as well. Now, I did want to go back to a statement, if I may, that was asked previously, and we've been doing a little research around Missouri, and there was an article. Missouri actually recently passed their House, I should say, not the Senate, but the House passed legislation approving compliance with this Real ID standard, and in part of a letter or an article that was posted, it quotes Representative Steve Lynch, and this is what it says. It says, Representative Steve Lynch, whose district encompasses part of the military base, Fort Leonard Wood, said the state inaction has caused problems in that area. Quote, everywhere I go, every weekend, I run into people that stop me and tell me, we need to fix this issue. He said, people are angry. They are frustrated. Many people still visit Fort Leonard Woods, but all of them are concerned that they may lose access to air travel next year, close quote. So that gives at least one person from Missouri's expression of concern about some of the challenges that they're having there. I'm going to pause and go to slide 5 if there's no questions.
Yeah, before you go on to there, your last bullet allows DMV to issue licenses to non-U.S. citizens with indefinite stays for up to 8 years. Are those both Real ID compliant and non-Real ID compliant licenses?
I believe the answer to that is yes. And Leslie, can you confirm that?
Through the chair, yes, Mr. Seaton, that is true, that they could be Real ID compliant.
And would you put yourself on the record?
Sorry, this is Leslie Riedel, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration.
Thanks. Okay. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, on that point, that could be for Ms. Riedel or for the Commissioner. It says up to 8 years. I'm assuming the up to takes into account that it, I believe, current law indicates that if they're green card or whatever may allow them in the country were to be up, that it expires at that time frame. Is that still correct?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yes, you're correct. So if a person had a green card that allowed them to be here for 5 years, the card would not go beyond the 5 years. But if they had an indefinite stay, I think Mr. Stanker could expand on this more, but there are some people who have indefinite stay cards, and so they could go up to the full 8 years, just like a normal license.
Thank you. I don't see any further questions, Mr. Commissioner.
Okay, so I'm moving to slide 5, and this describes what changes. And so if you take the current process that we use to issue a license as a baseline, the changes that will happen, first of all, we will take a photo of the individual at the beginning of the application process, and we will use that to compare against the same and ensure that the same individual that receives the license is the one who presented the documents at the beginning. We will then also validate the birth certificate, passport, or immigration documents that are presented as part of the process, and each one of those constitutes what we refer to as a dip into a database. There's a database that of all birth certificates, and we just validate that an individual's birth certificate is in that database, similar for passport and immigration documents. And so we are not establishing a database, we are just confirming that information is present in a database that's already existing. The other things that are there are fairly, I think, uncontroversial, that there would be a design that indicates that, or that would distinguish a Real ID compliant license from non-compliant cards, and then there would be an 8 year instead of 5 years. It's important to recognize that if the law is passed as it's written, for people who choose a non-compliant license, there are some implications, and in particular, they cannot, because we don't store any documents, they would not be eligible for online renewal, and they would also, if they lost a license, they would need to come back in with their primary document, with that birth certificate or with that passport. They would need to come in and show that in order to get a replacement. Today, if you lose a license, you can go to a DMV. We can visually confirm you are who you say you are and issue a license, a replacement license. So that will change under this legislation. Moving to slide 6. So in terms of what will not change, the DMV will still require a primary and secondary document to establish proof of Alaska residency. We will continue to do background checks, which we do today, both for our employees and for our business partners. And we will continue to use a secure facility to produce our licenses, both the compliant and non-compliant cards. Moving to slide 7. There's a lot of detail on this slide. Those that are highlighted represent the changes from our current process, and we're happy to go through this in detail, but it essentially is what I've just said. The yellow box at the front, kind of the upper left-hand quadrant, is the photo, and then the larger yellow box in the middle are the three different databases that we use to validate either the birth certificate, the passport, or the other immigration documentation that may be presented. I'm moving to slide 8. If there are questions. So in terms of the timeline, there are two dates that are coming up that are important. The first is June 7th. On that date, if our waiver expires without the reissuance of a new waiver, Alaska residents with an Alaskan license will need to present an alternative form of identification to get access to military bases and federal facilities. And then starting on January 22nd, 2018, either a real ID compliant license or another federal identification will be required to pass through TSA security checkpoints unless we've received a waiver. And then the final date is in October of 2020, and the Department of Homeland Security has notified us that no waivers will be granted past that date. And so that puts an outward boundary on when we need to have completed our work, assuming legislation passes, when we would need to have completed our work to be able to issue real ID compliant licenses. Are there any questions on that timeline?
Not seeing any questions at the committee.
All right, so moving to slide 9. This just describes, and I think Mr. Duffy from DNBA already did a nice job quantifying, but this gives a sense of who the people are that will be impacted by limited access to military bases, their state employees, school districts, both in Anchorage and Fairbanks, as well as civilians, people who work on the base, as well as visitors. And in particular, I think that there's a lot of construction that is contemplated in this coming construction season, so there's some concern about the impact on construction workers. And then moving to slide 10, and this is our last slide, it highlights those who support HB 74. And I think what you'll see is that, in particular, these are workers and individuals who would be impacted by the limitations or the restrictions that will be applied if we do not have a pathway to real ID compliant licenses, and just I think gives another kind of focus on the way we've tried to structure this legislation to make it a choice. So no Alaskan is required to get a real ID compliant license, but these are organizations that believe that their members have a particular interest and need to receive such a license. And that concludes my prepared remarks.
Okay, Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to make sure that, so the federal government is okay that, say, half the state decides they don't want a Real ID Act, that they would be able to get their ID by bringing in the same things they're bringing in right now. The only thing that's going to be saved is the application. And as long as we have an alternative plan, they're going to write it off as being in compliance.
So to be clear, those people who get a non-compliant license to enter into a federal facility, they will have to have an alternative form of identification. And so the federal government, we believe, based on conversations we've had with them, that they are comfortable with the notion that a group of people, that an individual to enter a federal facility will either have a license that is compliant, or they'll have an alternative form of identification.
Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki and then Gren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just going back to the Social Security number issue, if we're not required to produce a Social Security number to the federal government or anybody under the Real ID Act, why do we do that now?
Well, so we are required to validate certain information, including the presence of whether or not they have an alternative license in another state. And so we are required to validate that component is satisfied. And the federal law allows us, it doesn't require, but allows us to use the Social Security number to do that. And the system that has been established by AMBA is viewed as both efficient and minimally evasive method for doing it. And so we there's some further documentation if you would like it, but what we're trying to do is share the minimal amount of information that allows us to validate that this individual doesn't have another license in another state. If we didn't have this system, every time a person came in, we would have to reach out to 50 different states to validate that they didn't have a license, and it would be quite cumbersome.
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is this, when you said at the very beginning of your testimony about Social Security numbers that it's a requirement, is it a federal requirement? Is it a state requirement? Or is it a requirement of this one organization whom we work with?
The sharing of Social Security numbers is a requirement of the system that has been implemented by this organization to validate that an individual does not have a license in another state. It is important to acknowledge that we collect today Social Security numbers, and we do have to collect a Social Security number as part of Real ID. We are not obligated to share that with anyone else, but we are obligated to collect that information.
So,
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. So, I guess the question remains, we don't have to, by any law, or have share people's personal Social Security numbers. It's a requirement of an organization whom we're partner with for some reason.
Well, I guess be a little bit broader. I mean, we are required to validate that an individual does not have a driver's license in another state. We're required to do that under the Real ID Act, and we're required to do that under current state law. The Social Security number is the tool that allows us to do that. That so far no one has developed a better alternative process for being able to accomplish that function. And then with that in mind, then AMBA just created what is referred to as this pointer system that doesn't utilize the full Social Security number. It tried to take a subset of that, 5 digits in this case, and uses that to compare. Whether we do it through AMBA or whether we did it with every state, without utilizing the Social Security number, I think it would be impossible for us to confirm that the Sheldon Fisher that wants a license in Alaska is the same Sheldon Fisher that has a license in Kansas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there further questions? I did have a question, we do have other questions, sorry. But I wanted to ask about the chip that is talked about in here. So do all of the Real ID compliant cards have chips in them?
No, they do not. In fact, our Real ID compliant licenses will not have a chip. That reference to a license with a chip was a different license that is issued in some states for different purposes.
Okay.
We do not intend to issue a license that contains a chip.
Okay, I'm looking for my list of who I wrote down. I think it was Representative Gren and then Pruitt and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Commissioner, if right now when I go to get my driver's license and let's say we're compliant with Real ID in a few years, is there a difference in the information that I would share or need to provide to the DMV?
So when you, assuming we are authorized to issue Real ID compliant licenses and you want a license, such a license, the first time you come back to get that Real ID compliant license, you will have to bring a primary document again. And so you may have already done that. In the appendix in slide 12, I won't repeat it, but there's a list of what we refer to as primary documents. And at a high level, it's either a birth certificate, passport, or some other immigration information, and then a secondary document that establishes your residency in Alaska. And so you will have to present that anew to get that license. But that is actually essentially what people have been doing previously.
Follow up, Representative Gren.
And so this week, Commissioner, I had to go get my driver's license renewed, and I left the DMV with a black and white copy, and they said they'd mail me a new ID in the next 30 or 60 days. Is that going to be the same process that they'll have to send the information out and someone will mail me from out of state, I'm assuming, a new Real ID?
That is correct.
And follow up?
Follow up, Representative Gren.
Is it, and the information we send now, is that going to be sent to the same company who will issue Real IDs? Or is that a new company that will have new information?
It will be sent to the same company we use today. And that company stores the data for 30 days and then destroys it.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt and Guerra.
Yeah, thank you. A couple distinct different questions. But first one is in the same vein. So if someone loses their license, either one of the two versions, will they have to pay again?
I think we have a duplicate fee, but I don't recall exactly what it is.
Yeah, thank you. I don't actually care what it is. I know at one point we didn't, and I actually had a DMV employee who expressed that they thought that was an unwise decision because he was producing for the same people four or five times, and we weren't charging him. So I hope we do have a duplicate fee. The second question that I have is relates to then the time frame. It's kind of a two-part discussion, the time frame and then secondarily the employee need based on what it looks like from looking at the chart that you have here, that it's a little bit more extensive process. So if I'm going in to get my license, how much more time will it take to get a license if I decide to get the Real ID compliant? And then secondarily, how will that will impact your personnel needs? Or what would we expect, a decrease in the or a change in the amount of time for service at the DMV, which we already kind of joke around with is already a challenge?
Well, so I'm glad you asked the question because it gives me a chance to congratulate Marla, who's here with us in the room, at least with me and on the phone. So if you, over the last 18 months, our average wait time in the DMVs have gone from in excess of 45 minutes to under 10. And that has been, really, we did that without additional personnel. We've done it through what we would call process reengineering, lean techniques, really trying to streamline the steps in the process and also do a better job of managing our queue. And so we, when the queue gets long, we will actually pull people that might have ordinarily a back office function and use them in kind of in the queue so the queue never backs up. And I'm not going to say that every individual that comes in is served within 10 minutes, but we have dramatically reduced the wait time in our DMVs, and most weeks I get an email from a resident of Alaska that I don't know, thanking me and telling me about the great customer service they received from one of our reps. And so I'm generally speaking quite pleased. I think it's a great success story that has happened in our DMV. In terms of the schedule that you have, or the timing, the impact on the timing, I guess I would say that what we have listed here, we think we can accommodate in fairly short, you know, without a dramatic increase in time. And when I say listed here, I'm referring to chart 7 and the additional steps that we've reflected on this chart. We have worked to kind of develop a process and thought about how we would implement that, and I don't think we think it will be particularly burdensome. I will say that the more that we kind of put different processes and a, you know, different licenses or IDs follow different steps, and the more differences there are in the process, the less efficient that process becomes. And so I don't want to suggest that efficiency should trump privacy, because I agree with the sentiment that it probably shouldn't, but we are trying to be both efficient and respectful of people's privacy and be able to develop a system and approach that will allow us to be allow us to provide exceptional customer services, which is our ambition.
And one last question.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you for that, Commissioner, and I'm suspecting that I will have to experience whether or not that 10 minutes is works here probably later this summer, so I will let you know. But the last question that I had was related to, let's say you an individual from some southwest Alaska community that doesn't have a DMV located nearby or that they can access. Maybe they even have to fly to the nearest hub community that might have one. After 2020, if I read this correctly, they would not be able to use an Alaska license. But at this point, this is from looking at this, they have to be in person. This is a challenge, it seems like, for them to be able to get a real ID. So if an individual from a southwest Alaska community were to try to travel to Seattle, what kind of burden does this place on them for trying to get to even a place just outside of Alaska like Seattle? And how do we deal with that potential challenge?
I guess one thing I'd say is let's pass this legislation so that we can give them an alternative and give them the time that they need. And assuming this legislation passes, you know, we want to start to communicate with people and help them understand the need to get their license renewed with a real ID compliant license so they've got that. Frankly, if this legislation doesn't pass, then they're going to have a passport or some other form of identification, but it will be a challenge for them, and that's, I think, part of the reason why I'm motivated to give them the option to choose this and to give them as much time as possible to do that. Now, the other thing I would just actually, if I can put a plug in, Representative Pruitt, when you go to the DMV, there's actually a method now where you can set up an appointment. So you should go out to the website and look at that, and you can set up an appointment and even get, like, messaging. You can, anyway, it's pretty slick, so I would encourage you to use that when you go.
Yeah, one more follow-up on
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, right now, if I'm looking to get a passport, you can, depending on what stage you are, if you're renewing, you can actually mail it in, I believe. It's been a while. But so for this, I guess the point is that, I mean, I agree with you that this passage of this legislation is different from whether or not that person has access to a DMV. I guess really the kind of, I'm just trying to make sure that I understand, no matter what, Real ID for some of Alaska people in certain Alaska communities is going to disadvantage them and their ability to be able to transfer throughout the United States, whether we pass Real ID or not. Of course, more so, I think you'd argue without the passage of Real ID. But this is going to put a large burden on the ability and freedom of people to be able to move about their own country. Is that an appropriate statement?
I think what you're getting at is the burden is the burden that this is going to impose is that it's going to require they get a new license in the next couple of years, and I think that's a fact.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
and to clarify the question, is it that there's going to be a burden to get some kind of travel document, whether it's a passport or a Real ID compliant driver's license, in a time frame that we don't control other than through a waiver if we pass this bill? Is that correct?
Yeah, that would be a good summary. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Because, I mean, we just had a bill in front of us talking about off-highway licenses, right? And the discussion was the lack of access to a DMV. And so here these individuals have lack of access to a DMV, but yet they don't have the means, because we can't turn around and give them an off-highway license and kind of come up with another mechanism. It seems like to me that it will be tougher for some Alaskans to be able to travel if they decide that they wanted to. If they have to go through a Part 139 airport, which would require them to go through a TSA screening of some sort, of which we have 17 in Alaska. So just even traveling through those airports or traveling outside, I think there's a burden on them. And I don't know that there's really a solution we can come up with legislatively to solve that, because they have to be in person. But it is a burden, and we have to think about that.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Commissioner. You know, I'm trying to find a way to support the legislation given the travel problems it would create for people. But I do have some concerns. Oddly enough, the biggest privacy concern I've heard so far has nothing to do with Real ID. It's the it's what you mentioned about the Social Security numbers and the service that you use. That seems dangerous. And early on, you said. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. You said you were looking at options, but how comfortable can I be that you're going to find those options? Sitting here as one legislator, I see that as the biggest privacy concern that there is right now, and it's not even in the bill. But you raised it, and I'd like to know that there is going to be a solution, So let me know, what can you say about whether there is going to be a solution?
So if I thank you for that question and the opportunity to clarify. What I intended to communicate was that we are going to be attempting to reduce the number of digits that we share. I did not intend to communicate that we think we can eliminate 100% the idea that we would use a portion of the Social Security number. And so I think my expectation, and I think, frankly, I think this is true with or without Real ID. If we as a state want assurances, which the current state law requires, that an individual only has a single driver's license, and all 50 states have that restriction, including Alaska, I think that the Social Security number is the mechanism that allows us to do that. And so my effort, my ambition is to reduce the number of digits but not eliminate reliance on that mechanism.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Commissioner, can you just keep us apprised of the progress you make on that? I'm not really informed as to the danger of having two driver's licenses, but that does not seem to be among the biggest dangers in the world. But I know you have laws you have to follow. We have the law on the books, so you're following it. But please keep us apprised, because that's a concern of mine, the Social Security number problem that we have. The other question I have is have you looked at options to avoid this additional $20 licensing fee? So you have somebody who decides to comply with the law, and their reward for complying with the law is a license that's going to cost $20 more. I guess that's offset a little bit by the fact that it's going to last for 8 years instead of 5 years. But are there, like, very small fees you could sort of spread around a DMV, or even sort of go outside the box and find some fee in another department that really wouldn't be very burdensome to help pay for this, or maybe part of the motor fuels tax? It's a $20 license fee increase. Oddly enough, does cause me a little bit of concern. I'm just wondering if you've looked at other options to minimize that.
So, thank you, through the chair. The legislation that was proposed by the governor included a $5 fee increase. And that $5 fee increase is the minimal amount necessary to cover the incremental cost with each additional license. Some legislators were concerned about that this bill does have a fiscal note of approximately $1.5 million, and we can talk about that if you'd like, the details under that. But a number of legislators were concerned about using general fund money, if you will, to cover that cost, and wanted to increase that fee, the $5 fee, to a level that would quickly repay that $1.5 million, and that's where the $20 increment came from. And so this is a policy decision for you all to make. If you don't want us to charge a fee, then we can cover that in other places. In other words, the Department of Motor Vehicles makes money and returns money to the general fund of the state, and if we could not charge an incremental fee for this, we would just return a little bit less. Our license fees, candidly, are probably the least expensive in the country. I mean, a $20 license, which is our base license fee, is really very inexpensive compared to a lot of jurisdictions. So, but again, it's a policy decision for you all to decide how you want to handle it.
Thank you.
Representative Tilton, and then Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Fisher, in the documentation, the license would go from an 8-year with an ID, real ID, to from the 5-year for the regular ID. And just my question is about that is if we're using the same identification and what have you, where did that number come from for the 8 years? And, you know, just where are those numbers coming from? Why are they kind of a magical number there?
So thank you, Representative. Through the chair, the 5 years is what we've currently done. It's what we've historically done. And the Real ID Act allows a license to be issued for 8 years. And so as part of this, and in part along the lines of what Representative Guerra was referring to, recognizing there was to be a fee increase, we proposed to allow it to be extended to the maximum amount of time that the Real ID law would allow. And so there's nothing magical about those numbers. If the legislature wanted to be less, it could be, but that's the maximum amount that the Real ID Act will allow us to issue a license. And it does, the Real ID Act allows us to issue one renewal online, and so, you can get it up to 16 years before you have to come back into the DMV and have another picture taken.
So follow up.
Representative Tilton.
So the 5 years that we have on a standard ID is just what it's just always been, 5 years, or is that...
That's correct, Representative Tilton. That's just historically what the DMV has issued.
Thank you.
And Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you. Just thinking about the 5 to 8 year, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a problem, but it does mean since they have to come fewer times to the DMV, there will be less revenue to DMV in future years, out years. It's just an observation, a comment. I did have a question about the fiscal note, though, Commissioner Fisher. The cost breakdowns to get to the $1.5 million request, is that are those I guess there's startup fees, it looks like. Is there any additional fee that would go on into the future? And then secondly, do we pay to be a part of AMVA currently?
In terms of the fees, these are essentially all startup fees. There will be, as I mentioned before, there is a cost associated with each incremental license of $5, the $1.5 million, there's not a component of that that will kind of recur over time. With respect to AMBA, we do pay to participate in AMBA. It's a non-profit. Controlled by the states. As I mentioned, there's a board of directors, and our director of DMV will be joining that board shortly. But there is, you know, they have operations that need to be supported, and so there are fees. And I don't have those, but I can get those to you if you'd like.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then one more, just follow up.
Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fees that are required for this database going on into the future, a Real ID compliant database, are those reflected in the fiscal note?
Just to be clear, you're referring to the state-to-state database I described that we use to validate whether an individual has a license in a different state?
Yes.
So we already pay those today, and so they are not reflected in the data in the fiscal note because that we already pay that, and I think it's even a more efficient than the alternative mechanism we might develop.
And just like a really quick follow-up.
Kawasaki.
Thank you. And do those fees, have the fees ever gone up? Are they one of those? Are they one of the situations where you buy the license fee at the beginning, and then you're kind of stuck using it again and again, and the fees could go up, and then you find yourself that you never really can get out of that system?
Well, I got to confess, I'm sure the fees have gone up. I would need to get the detail to respond definitively, but the AMBA has been in existence since 1933, I believe. So I'm confident that as their service, either just based on inflation or as they provide more services, that those fees have changed and grown over time. I think the point, though, I would make, I guess, is first of all, it's nonprofit, so it's not charging fees based on a desire to return some profit to some business owner. This is managed by states, for states, and it's managed at a level to cover their cost.
And then,
follow up, Representative.
Thank you. And just one more question about AMVA. And I don't know if there's going to be a representative from AMVA to speak about what AMVA does, but so now they get basic comfort customer data, including our names, 5 digits of our Social Security number, our birth date. Have they in the past required more information or less information?
I'm going to let Marla Thompson, who's the director of the DMV, answer that. I know it's more information, but I don't have the details.
Okay, so this is Marla Thompson, and the data that we've provided, AMVA is a system, it's a backbone for us, and we've used it for CDLs and problem drivers. If you're coming from another state, there's a data dip that would allow us to know, do you have a DUI or have you lost your license because of points. So we've done that for a long time, many, many years, as well as there has been a dip with CDLs. So CDL requires that there's only one license as well, and we do, we've done that date, SIDLIS is the information on that. So the state-to-state is more of a evolution and not something, it's something that we've been doing with other pieces of data, just on things that we're required to do. Hopefully that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Commissioner or Ms. Riedel, maybe I'm reading the fiscal note wrong, but the way I read it, the costs of this are going to start out at $528,000, and they'll go down over the years. The revenue we get, maybe because of the increased license fee, is triple that, so $1.5 million in revenue, and then that goes down. Is it the fact that one of the committees increased the cost of the license that is generating more revenue than this bill costs, or am I missing something?
Through the chair, no, that's exactly right. The reason it is high and then drops down is we expect that many people will very quickly rush or, go to the DMV to get a replacement license, and then it'll kind of trail off after that initial surge. We believe that this, at $20, you're recovering costs above and beyond what is necessary to pay for this.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Look, obviously we've got to figure out a way to raise revenue in the state, but if we do these little things, my personal belief is we're going to irritate the heck out of people, like happened back in under Governor Murkowski's time. There were all these little fees. And what would we have to reduce the license fee back to just make this bill sort of cost neutral, where it raises about as much with the license fee as this bill costs, so we're not basically making money off of this bill?
So the number I would give you is $10. That covers the $5 associated with the incremental cost for each license, and then $5 would be collected, and our estimate is that over the course of 5 years, that would repay the $1.5 million. After that, that additional $5 actually would be incremental, but it's kind of a payback period of 5 years seemed like a reasonable approach. $10 total is kind of the number that we've been socializing.
Hey, Mr. Chair, so the picture that they utilize for a passport, is it the same type of facial recognition system as what is for the Real ID Act?
I'm sorry, can you ask that again?
So the Real ID Act talks about the facial recognition and making sure you're the same person as it goes along. Is the same type of facial recognition software, I guess for the best way, the same as is utilized for a passport?
I don't know that I can speak authoritatively over what they use for a passport, but let me talk a little bit about what we do and how it works. So when we take that photo, the system will compare the photo we take of you to other photos and, will present to the operator. If there are something that is a match, it will present other photos that have certain similarities, and then the customer service representative will look and inspect those photos, and it's a way of fraud detection to ensure that I didn't come in and get a different photo under a different name. We don't share those photos. We don't share any information from that photo facial recognition program. It's an internal tool that we use as a fraud detection mechanism. I can't speak with any authority about how the passports might
And Mr. Chairman, and I wish we could get, thank you. For my district, that's really important to know whether or not they're the same, and we do share it because we share it with public safety because that's what we just heard, is that they use pictures or all sorts of things in the different ways that they do it. So DMV doesn't keep it under lock for only the provisions of a driver's license. But I will see if I can find somebody that we need to contact to see what the difference is between a picture taken at the passport. Because I would think that the federal government is involved in both, and they wouldn't want you to have two passports from two states either. So I'll see if I can contact somebody.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, thank you for giving me the opportunity. You're 100% correct. When I said we don't share it, I meant outside of the state of Alaska. I don't want to be misleading. We do share it with public safety. We do share it with the Office of Children's Services, and we do share it with PFD. And so I acknowledge that we do share that information across the state to ensure that there's not fraudulent behavior in the state of Alaska. And so my intention was to clarify that we don't share it outside of Alaska. In terms of the passport, the passport is issued by the federal government, not by any state, and so you're right. I'm sure they have a series of mechanisms to ensure that their passports are secure and validated, but we don't share any of our data with them to that end, and I don't know how they do it.
Thank you.
Commissioner, the Department of Public Safety raised a concern. I've lost my notes here, so I'm not sure if I asked this before, but does the department have any objection to holding the database in encrypted form for a longer period of time than is specified in the bill?
Do you mean the Department of Administration or the Department of Public Safety?
Department of Administration, the DMV, where it's...
No, we currently encrypt all the data, and we will continue to encrypt that data, we have no objection to keeping the data longer if the legislature would like that. Of course, some aspects of the bill kind of cut the other way, and we obviously will comply with legislation when adopted.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. I did want to share with the committee that, you know, we had some discussion outside of here on a passport card and the issuance of that at the $55 and whether that could be used. And so we just gave everybody the information there that you can get a passport or a passport card, but the passport card cannot be used for air transportation into Canada, Mexico, or other foreign countries. It can be used for land or sea crossing into Mexico and Canada, but it's not, even though it's issued at the same time the passport is, and it's issued by the federal government, it will not serve for air transportation between the United States and Canada or Mexico. Representative Wilson, you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, neither will this Real ID Act either. You'll still have to have a passport for all those things, correct? A Real ID will let you do things I can't go to Europe without a passport. Can't go to Europe with just a Real ID card either.
You can go to Canada and to Mexico under a driver's license, a Real ID driver's license. My understanding is you will be able to use a Real ID driver's license to go into Canada and Mexico by air. The passport card, you're not able to. So if there's any clarification to that, that doesn't work, we want to get this all correct. So as our further testimony, or do you have information?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Leslie Riedel. I do think that you need a passport to travel to a foreign country by air and driving through Canada.
I know, and in Mexico, too?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
But the passport card is good.
Sorry. Yeah, We'll have to get some verification on that for Canada and Mexico. So now let's go. We also have we had Department of Public Safety. Did they have anything to add on before we go to Bob Dole? Bob Dole, are you there? Do you wish to add anything?
Mr. Co-Chair, this is Brian Duffy. I do not believe that Mr. Dole is on, but I am prepared to provide additional commentary for the committee's consideration.
That's fine. You were next on the list there. I just want to go down and make sure we get it. So, Mr. Duffy, would you go ahead and reintroduce yourself on the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian Duffy. I am the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And I'll depart briefly from my prepared comments because we covered some of the items earlier. What I'd like to emphasize for the members of the committee is it's important to understand that federal installations, such as Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, are complying with provisions of the Real ID Act now. Visitors who wish to obtain unescorted access and do not have identification cards compliant with the Real ID Act are being denied entry or required to be escorted by a DOD ID card holder while on the installation. This includes individuals with driver's licenses from Maine, Missouri, and Montana, and those with non-enhanced licenses from Minnesota, and we spoke earlier to the changes underway in Washington State. If there is no change in statute by Alaska's extension expiration date of 6 July 2017, Alaska driver's licenses and similar identification cards from six additional states, assuming no change from them as well, will simply be added to the list of identification cards designated as insufficient, much like Maine and Montana were added at the end of January 2017. The installations have no waiver authority, and there should be no expectation they would pursue any. I spoke earlier to the magnitude of the challenge that will be associated with those wishing to obtain unescorted access to installations in the state, specifically at JABER. Leaders here estimate some 14,000 contractors and local service providers, and up north, about 5,000 per month at Fort Wainwright and 2,600 per month at Eielson. In the case of Joint Base Elmendorf, there are approximately 50 different mission partners on the installation, some federal, some state, with others from either public or private organizations. And currently, those without other Department of Defense credentials can be issued from the base a Defense Biometrics Identification System, or DBIS card, to obtain unescorted access. Upon that card's normal expiration date, and absent again a change in the statute, individuals will need a different form of Real ID compliant identification other than their current Alaska driver's license in order to renew that DBIS card. And in coordination with the Department of Administration and the Governor's Office, last month our Adjutant General and Commissioner published instructions to our DMVA teammates, about 260 in all, who work on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and other U.S. military installations in Alaska, advising them of their potential impact and their potential need for action to ensure they can get to work. However, it's not only our state of Alaska employees and the DMVA that are likely to be affected. I anticipate in future testimony you'll hear from other labor providers, the Anchorage School District, and a few more, but internal to the DMVA family, our recently arrived class for the Alaska Military Youth Academy is affected as well. With almost half of the students being 18 years or older or being projected to turn 18 while enrolled, they will also need Real ID compliant forms of identification to obtain this DBIS card for continued base access during their period of instruction. And while many of the community events they participate in have our AMIA team providing transportation, there are other periods, for example, personal or medical appointments, where the students are escorted by their parents or their relatives. And then finally, with a significant part of the AMIA program relying on the participation of sponsors to come to the installation to visit the AMIA campus, we see a potential additional adverse action for these individuals in order to secure, as they choose or try to secure unescorted access. So, Mr. Chairman, again, thanks for the opportunity to provide some additional commentary, and I certainly stand ready to answer any questions you or the committee members may have.
Representative Kawasaki has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. So I guess it's been like 20 years or so. When I was a kid, I used to have a friend that was who was a dependent military. So in order for us to access base, we had to go to the little the station and get a thing for my car window. But because he had his ID, military issued dependent ID, we could get on post and go hang out at the arcade. Somewhere along the line, it became more frequent that anybody could just access base. Can you just tell me a little bit more about, I mean, just generalized access, and then I have a follow-up on that.
Sure. Through the chair, this is Brian Guth again, Rep. Kawasaki. I think you're speaking of what we now know as the Trusted Traveler Program. So my example is a good one. So I'm a retired DOD individual. I've got a retired DOD ID card. Under the Trusted Traveler Program, I may escort, I believe the threshold at JABER is up to 9 people on the installation who have some other form of valid ID. It doesn't have to necessarily be real ID compliant. I can escort them onto the installation, go about our business, but I must remain an escort of them while they're on the installation, and then upon, you know, termination of our business, I escort them off the base. So to build on that, I think to anticipate that the installation would be in a position to escort those 14,000 service providers on a routine basis is not something they're going to be able to do, and it's not sustainable. Finally, in the Joint Armed Services Committee hearing, I think you may recall that Senator Wilsbach speaking to that challenge, and the folks, you know, on the installation really have day jobs and day training they're attending to rather than providing recurring escort. Over.
Thank you. That would be quite the carpool. Another question I had, Mr. Duffy, is that there's, if you, I know if you're a member of JASC, if you're a member of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, and maybe if you live near a base, they issue identification cards to members of this legislature. They're the USARAC ID cards, the upright ones. Are those real ID compliant?
So, through the chair, Rep. Kawasaki, so those cards themselves don't have to be real ID compliant, right? So in order to get that card, you have to present a form of identification that is real ID compliant. So, for example, the Defense Biometrics Identification Card, which that one you refer to as a form of, is something the installation issues. And to do that, they take a Real ID Act form, compliant form of ID, they look at that, they validate it, they perform some additional checks, and then they'll issue you that card that you mentioned. And that's the way that process works. Over.
Okay. And so, through the chair.
Representative Kawasaki.
So you would still have to have a Real ID compliant ID before you can get the USARAC installation card, then, is what you're saying.
Yeah, through the chair, Rep. Kawasaki, the answer is yes, and I'll give you an additional example. So if an Anchorage school district employee has issued a DBIDS card in September of 2016, he or she may have used their Alaska driver's license in its current form to get that card. As that card looks to expire in September of 2017, if there's no change in the statute, the current Alaska driver's license will be insufficient to renew that card. Over.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Duffy.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Now we'll go to Ms. Tara Rich. Are you online?
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tara Rich. I'm the Legal and Policy Director of the ACLU of Alaska.
Well, thank you. Would you go ahead with your testimony?
Sure. So, although, as many of you probably are aware, the ACLU's long-stated position has been to oppose Real ID in the federal sense, and we supported the legislature's resistance back in 2008. We recognize the political reality that the legislature is currently faced with, having to choose between two terrible choices that it seems nobody asked for. And so I wanted to walk through just briefly the version of the bill that's coming to you from the House State Affairs Committee, because it really has been a product of us working earnestly and in good faith with the Department of Administration to ensure that if Alaska does become compliant through this legislation, that it has the least amount of privacy-invasive policies as possible. And so at the outset, you know, we had requested a number of provisions to be included within the legislation, including that the number of documents, the minimum number of documents that Real ID requires would be fixed so that DMV would require no more than the minimum, that the time frame for retention of those documents would be fixed, so that the Alaska DMV would retain documents for no more than the minimum time frame required by Real ID, that there would be no bulk sharing of photographs and so or other documents. And so I think that actually goes directly to Representative Guerra's question about sharing photographs between between DMV and public safety. So as the legislation is currently drafted, that would be prohibited because there is no bulk sharing, and that no documents that are not required by Real ID, by the federal legislation, would be obtained by DMV. And lastly, although Real ID would require that your picture be retained if you don't obtain a driver's license or identification card for at least 5 years, if you're obtaining a non-Real ID card, that your picture would not be retained by DMV because we don't see any real purpose for that, and it's also a significant privacy concern. So we weren't able to get every, you know, everything that we wanted, and we, you know, in talking with DMV and finding out about what the Department of Homeland Security was going to require, you know, the issue of social security numbers being provided to this interstate pointer system was a focal point in the State Affairs Committee, and we came to the conclusion that if the law were to require that social security numbers do not get sent to the interstate pointer system, that Alaska would not be deemed compliant. And so if compliance is the goal of this legislation, that that would not be a feasible part to include in HB 74. And so, you know, other things that we'd requested, for example, paper applications, you know, as existing part of DMV's infrastructure, they already scan these documents, and so it wasn't realistic for us to get everything that we wanted. But I want to focus on two areas I think that there does remain to be some movement.